I feel this real gratitude that there is this culture, this tribe of runners out there that are out there in the wilderness, you know, living their lives, and that they do things that we're all interested in. And I get the lucky chance to tell their stories.
All right. We ready?
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Don. You know, I mean, I didn't know what it was going to be like. You know, you sound like a nice guy on this podcast, but
I know it's on the upper edge and you guys have won a couple of awards and
I've never prepped for a podcast ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing.
What are you balancing your checkbook over there, AJW? What's going on?
Yeah.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything. All right. Are we ready?
Yeah.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Don Freeman.
And I'm Scott War. And, you know, we've been doing some reflections in the last few podcasts. I'm kind of reflecting on our 9 years doing podcasts and over 500 episodes. And we're inviting guests on that have been on before. And we're super excited about this guest. Back in 2009, he wrote a small book that was kind of a niche book, if I recall right. It didn't get a lot of purchases back then. It was called Born to Run. I'm trying to be sarcastic, Don. You're scratching your head.
Yeah, I thought this isn't at all how we planned the intro, Scott, to bash our guest.
But we decided we would get Christopher McDougall back on. Chris, you're back with us. We are super excited to have you here.
I think the best introduction for me would have just have been to hang up at that point. Just click off.
We would have totally understood that. But we were thinking back to this book, Born to Run. And as Don and I were on a run this morning, we started thinking, okay, how many of us bought chia seeds because of that book? I did.
I did too.
How many of us bought Huarache sandals because of that book? I did.
Me.
How many of us bought Vibram Five Fingers because of that book? I did. You know, there are so many things that came out of that book.
I want to add a couple, Scott. How many of us believed and truly believed, and it's true, that we're natural born runners, that we're able to get out there and do some incredible things? Our ancestors had done it. And Chris brought in some studies and scientists that have been saying these things, and they became household names. So we learned that our powerful glute muscles and hamstrings and our ability to sweat and lose perspiration and heat allowed us to survive and allowed our brains to grow big because of the protein. All of these things were introduced in a great story by Christopher McDougall in Born to Run. I'm sure most people have read it, but if you haven't, read it. It's amazing.
And we thought, we're going to get a chance to sit down with Chris for 1 hour. What are we going to talk about? And my first question for Chris is, Chris, you wrote this book in 2009, and if you look at the running surge, it kind of mirrored when that book came out. Do you think that the Born to Run book actually caused people to believe that they could run?
Chris, are you the reason I can't get into Western states again?
Honestly, yes to B. As for question A, yeah, well, you know, it's a weird thing. To be honest, it's kind of hard to figure out chicken and egg stuff because, honestly, you know, listen, man, I would love to pat myself on the back, and you guys are actually doing a great job of it. I fully endorse everything you just said. But I can't really distinguish, like, what was going on anymore. My best recollection is this stuff was all happening. Like, the reason why Born to Run sold well is because all this stuff was brewing. Like, the clouds were gathering. In particular, let's look at, like, barefoot running. You know, at the time, this was kind of niche. It was kind of weird. You know, you had guys like Barefoot Ken Bob and Barefoot Ted out there in the wilderness doing their thing. No one was paying much attention, but at the same time, like, their numbers were growing. Like, people believed it, and they had performance and science on their side. So after Born to Run, you know, barefoot running, minimalist running really took off. But honestly, I think what happened was, like, the wave was building, and I happened to be paddling at just the right time, just the right place.
Did you see that coming, Chris? Did you say, oh, there's the wave, I'm going to catch it? Or were you just out there drifting and coming up with this idea for this book, and all of a sudden you're swept up in the momentum?
Yeah, I think what was happening was that a lot of people were on the same trajectory I was on. A lot of people were having the same questions I was on, and there just hadn't been a unifying narrative yet to bring it all together. So, I mean, I think we all have the common experience to this day. You're told over and over again, you know, replace your running shoes after 300 miles. 300 miles, you got it.
Right.
Remember, Runner's World would tell you to take a Sharpie and write on the midsole, like the date you bought them or number of miles or something like that. And then you're supposed to check them and then buy a new pair of shoes. And then you walk into the running shoe store and you look at this freaking wall of shoes. Like, what? You know, first of all, the pair I just bought 3 months ago is now gone, never to be seen again. And the replacement doesn't look anything like it. So you buy the Pegasus in 2021. It looks nothing like the Pegasus in 2020. And so why has it got the same name? And then you ask the clerk, and they're just throwing a bunch of stuff at you. So I think everyone, no matter how experienced a runner you were just baffled by running shoes. And then once you're baffled, at some point you start to think, is someone bullshitting me? Like, is this a con? And so that's where I was in my own thinking. And I think lots of other people were as well. Barefoot running was just starting to make its presence felt a little bit. I was skeptical and intrigued, and I think a lot of other people were as well. So I think that was basically it, that there were all these little vibrations out there. And for me, the galvanizing thing was I had this experience in the Copper Canyon. I saw the Tarahumara, and their experience, their lifestyle, pulled all those threads together. They're minimalist runners. They're eating chia. They're running hundreds of miles. They're guys in their 80s and kids in their teens and women of all ages and sizes and body shapes. They're all doing it. And so that led me to believe, listen, if they can do it, I can do it. If they're wearing minimal shoes, maybe I should. And whatever they're eating, maybe I should eat it too.
You know, I was just with some family, some extended family last week. We were distanced, Freeman. And we were wearing masks, but I was with them, and they know that I do a little bit of running, and I heard this over and over and over from people that were are my age and even younger. They said, "Oh, you know what? I would love to run, but I have bad knees." And I was thinking, you know, the Tarahumara, the 80-year-olds are out there running, so that can't be the reason that they have bad knees, is because of running. I think, in my opinion, running helps build the fascia and makes you more able to run longer.
I mean, that was exactly my experience. To me, that was, you know, it's funny because there's a weird chapter two of Born to Run, you know, that I said this whole thing started because my foot hurt. And to me, that was actually the introduction. So I don't really like introductions in books. If I've opened a book and there's an introduction, I skip it and get right to chapter one. So I didn't want to be guilty of the same thing. But I felt like I needed to let people know, hey, I'm not Scott Jurek, you know, like I'm not the guy that I'm writing about. I'm you guys. I'm a guy that was told not to run because it's bad for your body. So I wanted that stuff in there. And that's why chapter two is really the introduction to the book, where I echo exactly what you're saying. That I'm the guy with the bad knees and the bad back and the bad feet that was told by doctors, you're the size of a freaking refrigerator. You shouldn't be running. You're too big. It's bad for your body. And that to me was a launching spot, was so many people are told this or believe it. And what I was finding out was it's not true.
When I hear the words, I have bad knees, it makes me think, what, you're knees bend the opposite way? They don't work like our knees? What are you talking about, bad knees? But boy, aren't we quick to latch on to that? Oh, my doctor said I should never run. It's like, wow, what a that statement made by that doctor influenced that person's life and health for decades. And that's just crazy.
It's awful. But again, you know, it's hard to point a finger and lay blame. So the patient is feeling pain. Pain is a warning signal. Don't do this. Pain tells you you should not be doing this behavior. They go to a doctor who's trying to look out for the patient, and all of the information out there is telling you running is bad. The entire running shoe industry is really based on the fact that running is bad. And the only way you're going to escape injury is if you buy this product. So in a way, the running shoe industry is reinforcing that message.
That's kind of like the seatbelt industry for the cars, you know. Driving a car is dangerous. Put this on. It's like running is dangerous. Buy these big shoes with big cushions
on them. Yeah, except that people are not trying to sell seatbelts, you know, or using the seatbelts to sell the cars. But the running shoe industry is using this fear of injury as a way to sell their products. And that to me was the huge eye-opener, was that, oh, yeah, you know, the Tarahumara aren't wearing these things. Barefoot Ted is a stocky dude. He's not wearing these things. And then you think back in history, you know, running shoes only really became prevalent in the 70s and 80s. Well, what were people wearing in the 50s, 60s, and beyond? You know, we didn't just invent running in 1972. It had been around forever. But what we did invent were these big motion-controlling, overly cushioned shoes, which are backed by no science whatsoever. So I think that is one of the sad aspects of it, is the shoe industry is pushing this message that if you don't buy their product, you will get hurt. Doctors pick it up because people show up who are hurt, and it becomes this cycle of fear that really gets into people's minds.
Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
I was just going to say, and one of the there's so many good things about this book, but one of the things that we benefited directly from is one of the characters in the book, Dr. Mark Cucuzella, who you talk to, is a very good friend of ours now, and he's been on this podcast probably 20 times. And here is a doctor that has a different narrative that says, if you're hurting, it may be because you're running improperly. Let's do a gait analysis. Let's get you in some good shoes, and let's reinvent, or not reinvent, but let's
Jay Dashari, rewire.
Yeah, rewire back to the way that we were supposed to run. Take your shoes off and go run in your bare feet, and you'll learn to run properly.
Steve Gangemi.
Yeah, yeah.
We've got a lot of people that came from you, Chris. You're the reason we're here.
Yeah, again, Jimmy's, you know, the natural movement guys, Cucuzella. I mean, they're out there, but unfortunately they are sort of blitzed by this overwhelming message. I mean, look what happened with minimalism. What came the next year? Maximalism, you know, the most cushioning possible. And I guess, you know, again, I sometimes regret the fact that the conversation is so much about shoes. As you pointed out about Mark Cucuzella, he doesn't really want to talk about shoes. He wants to talk about technique. And like the simple clarity of his message is, if you have a behavior that is causing pain, change the behavior. It's the same thing you do everything else. You know, you stand up and you bang your head. Well, stand up differently. And what he's saying is, if you're hitting the ground in a way that's causing pain, don't just keep adding things to the problem. Change the way you land on the ground.
Now, so some of the things that I think where people got in trouble is, or where we get in trouble, as we grow up, we're put in shoes early, and we keep our feet protected from the environment at all costs, from the time where we first stand until the time we learn that, hey, wait a minute, I want to be a barefoot runner. Then after 40 years and maybe a few extra pounds, we take the shoes off and we go run. We need a time to adapt. You know, conveniently, as an infant, we only weigh, what time we stand up, I don't know, you know, 25 pounds or something. And we start and gradually make our way through and toughen up our feet and condition as we grow. Now, we don't pop our shoes off at 40 and go out and try to run a marathon on the trail. That's dangerous.
I'll take you one step beyond, too, is that we are rarely on our feet these days. You know, if you're with the Tarahumara, they don't have chairs in their houses. They either squat on the ground or they're walking all the time. At age 40, wow. Think about how much time in your daily life you're actually moving your legs. It's pretty minimal. And so you decide at age 42, you know what, man, I've overindulged. It's time to lose some weight. I'm going to go out and run. Of your 24-hour day, 22 and a half of them are spent either on your ass or on your back. And then you're going to jump up, blast out the door for 40 minutes, you know, and somehow your body is supposed to adjust to that abrupt change.
Hey, Chris, you kind of brought it up at the beginning. For those of the listeners that haven't read Born to Run or haven't read it in 11 years, recount how you got into writing this book. You said you had some pain in your foot. Tell us a little bit about that story and how that started the idea of writing a book on running.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. I'm glad you mentioned that because I realized in this conversation, we're actually kind of focusing on negatives, you know, like running shoes are crap and, you know, doctors are crap and everything's crap. And I realized that's actually not the vibe of Born to Run. And when I look back on it, you know, because when you write a book, especially a running book in 2009, you assume that no one's going to read it. There's no market for it. Because back in 2009, there was only one running book that was attracting any attention at all. And that was Ultramarathon Man by Dean Karnazes, which is a terrific book. And I very consciously tried to understand what Dean did, because his book was a breakout and the only popular running book on the shelf. You can't, there's no second place. You know, Dean was winning by a country mile. And when I read his book and tried to figure out what did he do that no other writers about running have done, and I realized it's a really happy book. Like, Dean's a happy dude. And what comes across in this book is a lot of fun. You know, it's a lot of fun. Dean's having a good time out there rolling up a pizza into a tube and shoving it down his gob, you know, and eating a whole cheesecake while he's running 250 miles. So it stuck in my head that most of the time when people are talking about running, they're talking about their injuries or their pain or how hard a marathon is. That's the popular conception, is that running equals punishment. But Dean had a different message. Running could be a hoot. And so when I was thinking about this, I thought, man, it'd be really cool to do a book about ultramarathoners that aren't just about one dude, because Dean's book was, you know, mostly only about Dean. And then I had this bizarre adventure in the Copper Canyon, and what stuck in my head was, make sure you stress the fun. You know, the fact that you guys today, why were you late? Because you're having fun, you know? You had a choice. I can either get back in time for this podcast, or I can have some more fun. And dude, I fully endorse what you did. So I'll take you back to answer your question. So what happened with Born to Run was, I was actually writing for Runner's World magazine, and I had done an article about Lisa Smith Batchen up in Idaho, who had just done a series of ultramarathons. And she discovered that she was actually struggling with clinical depression. So her running and her depression were sort of linked together. And she couldn't tell if the running was fueling her depression or was curing it. Like, she wasn't sure. Is it medicine or is it poison? And so I wrote an article about her. And that was my first introduction to ultra runners. And I hung out with her a little bit and Marshall Ulrich, who's her good buddy. And I started to think, man, it would be really cool to do a book about a group of ultra runners coming together for a race. And my concept at the time was, maybe I'll just pick four ultra runners like Lisa and Marshall and two others and follow their lives during the course of a year and then catch up with them at some like climactic race like Badwater. Wouldn't that be a cool book? But as I was conceptualizing this, at the same time, I had this assignment to go down to the Copper Canyon and check out the Tarahumara, and I met Caballo Blanco. And then I started to train, and then I go down for the race. And it literally wasn't until after the race that I was on my way back to the United States. And I'm like, oh, yeah, dude, remember that thing you wanted to write about? It just happened. Like, I never thought of it as a book until after the whole adventure had happened.
Huh. So did you recreate the next? Because you ended up bringing Scott Jurek together and a bunch of names that we're familiar with. Was that the next year, or was that the year that you went down to the Copper Canyon?
That was the year down to the Copper Canyon. So the whole genesis was this, was, let's see. So I was in Chihuahua. I was doing a piece for the New York Times Magazine about, I don't know if you guys actually know this story. I was actually in Mexico to do a story for the New York Times Magazine about a Mexican pop star who was secretly running her own brainwashing sex cult. Have we ever discussed this before?
No. But I'm going to turn my volume up. This is going to be good.
You have me hooked. There may be a follow-up to the Born to Run book here.
There's actually a prequel to it. And the thing about it is, you know, you get to me, I guess my short-term memory is just like down to like 17 minutes. Like, I just don't remember beyond what happened, you know, an hour ago, that I kind of forgot about this until I was on book tour recently for Running with Sherman. And I was looking for giveaway prizes. And I was like down in the basement looking through some boxes. I'm like, oh, yeah, my first book, Girl Trouble. I forgot about it. I forgot. I'd actually written a book about this sex cult. And I had a bunch. And the reason why they're all in my basement is because no one ever bought them. And so I would do this as a giveaway. So I was doing Running with Sherman events. And I would go up there and say, okay, I got a giveaway prize. Who can name the title of my first book? And like 15 hands would go up. People would go, Born to Run. And I'd go, very confident, but incorrect, you know. It's actually this. It's Girl Trouble. So what happened was, I heard about this brainwashing sex cult from a pop star in Mexico. I went down to look into it. I was in Chihuahua. And while I'm in Chihuahua, I kept seeing these images of these dudes in dresses and sandals running. And I started to ask, well, who are these guys? And someone said, well, they're the Tarahumara. They are like the sort of the local pride of the Chihuahua region that live down this Copper Canyon. They're amazing runners. And I'm like, I write for Runner's World. How come I've never heard of these dudes? So I went down to the Copper Canyon, and that was my first encounter with Caballo Blanco, Micah True. And he said, hey, man, I want to do this race. So you go back up to the outside world, you get me some racers, and I'll let you in this race. So at the time, I was not really a runner. You know, I was 50 pounds out of shape. I'd been injured. And that's what got the wheels turning. Like, hey, I wonder if I can actually do this. Can I go from 0 to 50 miles in 9 months? Can I persuade any runners to actually join me? Can this guy, this weird dude living in the bottom of a canyon with the phony made-up name, can he actually put this race on? And so I went back home, and I coincidentally, with another magazine assignment, I met Eric Orton, who's this great trainer and coach up in Jackson Hole. And his eyes just lit up when I told him about this. So he began to train me. I reached out to Scott Jorick and Luis Escobar. And bit by bit, like, you know, the band started to come together. But until the day I arrived in El Paso to go down for it, I wasn't 100% sure that anybody was going to show up.
Can you recreate the conversation, the call to Scott Jurek? How did that go?
Actually,
hey, Scott.
I was actually wrong. It was reverse. Scott actually reached out to me. So what had happened was I wrote a piece for Runner's World about my first trip down to the Copper Canyon and my visit with Caballo. And Scott read it, and he'd been getting letters from this guy, Micah True, for a couple of years. Because, you know, Scott back then was still the great Olympian god, you know, like knowing seven Western states. To this day, I still can't get it through my head. How the F do you win seven? How do you show up at the starting line 7 years in a row ready to race 100 miles? Like, I still don't get it how he did it.
Yeah, there's so many variables, not to get off tangent too much, so many variables of showing up, peaking, and other extreme athletes, elite athletes of the world, showing up at their best. And you, for seven times, best them and come up at your peak to beat their peak every time. I mean, there's a lot to be said for what he accomplished.
It's baffling.
And a local runner here, Tim Tweetmeyer, five-time Western States winner. I mean, that race at one time, between those the seven and the five, this 12 years was dominated by these two, not to exclude the 14 times won by Ann Trason. How does she show up and just dominate? It's scattered about a bit now. We don't have that much domination. You know, the Muhammad Ali champion that just ruled the ring for a while. It's I wonder if the rest of the running community caught up to them, or they were just that much better. You know, well, that isn't even a statement, but you know what I mean.
I do, and it's intriguing because not only just showing up at your peak, but so much can go wrong in 10 miles, let alone 100 miles, 100 miles through canyons, you know? And we see it all the time. Dudes who just miss a trail marker and they lose a couple miles, or, you know, your stomach's off and you're not, you know, you love cantaloupe, but this day cantaloupe's not going down. You know, it's just, that's what just is mind-boggling. And then, you know, it's that whole kind of thing, like, you know, would LeBron James, you know, how would he stack up against Will Chamberlain? You know, so even though players may be superior now, they have far more going for them in terms of knowledge and technology. So you get Ann Trason, back in those days, you know, she didn't have cliff shots, you know, she didn't have like all the kind of stuff the guys had. They didn't have hydration vests, you know, they didn't have ultimate direction vests. So the fact that she could dominate for 100 miles year after year with so little knowledge and equipment to back her up, again, it's just mind-boggling.
And what if she had 250 miles on her shoes? I mean, that would have thrown it out right
exactly,
there.
Exactly, right. Kind of teaches you a lesson right there about the shoes, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So Scott Jurek called you and said, I've been harassed by this guy named Caballo Blanco, and is he for real? And
yeah,
I'm ready to do it?
Yeah. Yeah, again, you know, looking back, so much of it was so weird. You know, at the time, I was just kind of rolling with it as it came. And also, I barely knew who Scott Jurek was. Again, I'm a complete outsider to the ultra-marathoning scene. I'd never run an ultra. I wasn't even running at all. And so I was aware of Scott, but I wasn't like, you know, the fanboy that I am today. You know, back then, that guy, I know his name. And it's like an email out of the blue from Scott Jurek saying, hey, you know, what's the deal? This guy legit. I've been getting messages from him for a couple of years. I just thought he was a crackpot. And I said, well, you're not wrong.
He is.
But, yeah, he's really putting this race on. And then, yeah, that's when Scott looped in Luis Escobar, who then circled back with me, too, to say, hey, is this guy, you know, seriously, is he going to do this thing? I'll come down and shoot pictures. I had interviewed Jen Shelton for an article about women, and I was kind of examining that whole topic of why it is that women can hold their own in the upper echelons of these long-distance races. And I said, hey, by the way, I'm going down for this race in a couple of months, you know, if you're interested. And she's like, yeah, I'm interested. So she called Billy Bonehead, and that's how it all started to come together.
Can you tell us a little bit about Caballo Blanco? I mean, he shows up as this mystery in your book. Can you, I don't want to say pay tribute, but certainly you could just share with us your experience with Caballo Blanco.
Yeah, it was definitely one of a kind. And, you know, it's funny. There's lots of thoughts running through my mind. You know, at the time, he was so difficult to figure out. And now with the benefit of hindsight, I kind of get him a lot more. And just before his death, he met this wonderful woman. You guys might know. Did you ever meet Maria Walton, his girlfriend?
No.
Oh, yeah. No. She's the best. And yeah, so I'm telling a story in completely like mixed up fashion, but yeah, I'm going to talk in reverse order. I'm going to do this memento style. So what happened was, okay, after Born to Run came out, there's a woman in Arizona named Maria Walton. And she's very sweet, very cool, but sort of like indomitable. Like, you know, Maria was like a P.F. Chang senior executive. And so she gets things done. And even though she's a total free spirit and her symbol is the butterfly, that butterfly has got some stone cold ones, and she will get what she wants and she'll get it done. So she reached out to Micah because she wanted to run her first ultra and she wanted him to like guide her and coach her. And he's like, dude, just because I was in a book doesn't mean I'm like coaching people. And I live in the bottom of a canyon. And it's not going to happen. And she persisted and they met up and they went for some runs together and they fell in love. And a guy that you think is just chiseled out of granite, you just watched him like melt and turn to putty before your eyes. He just became a much softer, happier, gentler guy. And then we saw that the heart, you know, like the Grinch, like the heart that was within, you know, beat 10 sizes larger that day. He just became like friendlier and happier. So it had always been there. But at the time when we first went down to the Copper Canyon, he was just kind of this like surly, unhappy, solitary dude. And my most visual memory was when the whole gang got together in El Paso and we're riding buses and we get down to the town. Town of Creel, where we're going to meet up with Micah, and he meets us at the bus. And I just kind of see him like looking up and down at this motley crew. And he just kind of like shook his head like, no, this is not what I want at all. And he was like that for the first couple of days, seriously not digging the scene. Barefoot Ted was in his ear driving him crazy. Jen and Billy were drinking their faces off. Scott was also kind of like, what the fuck am I doing here? So he was kind of withdrawn. So it all seemed like it was not going to happen.
Wow. So I've got to ask you, do you know, who gave Micah True his name, Caballo Blanco? Was it self-given? Did the people around give it to him? How did that happen?
At first, it tagged him in Guatemala. So he was, before he started hunkering in the Copper Canyon, he would go to Guatemala and run, doing the same thing. So he would work in Boulder, moving furniture for a few months each year. And then once he had bankrolled enough cash, he took off for South America. And so he was in Guatemala doing the same thing, running trails. And down there, kids started calling him Caballo Blanco because he was like long, flowing, blonde hair and super white skin. And then in, I believe what happened in Copper Canyons was when he would run through a village. So a lot of the Tarahumara don't even speak Spanish. They speak their own indigenous language. So even though Caballo had some Spanish under his belt, he didn't speak Tarahumara. So he'd come into a village and he couldn't communicate at all. So then he would just kind of stomp his foot and like neigh like a horse and then go running off again. And so I think that's how they came to know him as this, Caballo Blanco, this big blonde horsey dude.
Boy, such a great conversation with Christopher McDougall. I can't believe that he's actually agreed to talk to us. But we're going to take a one-minute break and tell you, Don and I went on a run this morning. Chris talked about that we were late for the podcast because I run so slow, and Don was behind me on a single track, so he couldn't pass. When we got out of our cars this morning to go running, what jacket were you wearing, Freeman?
Well, you know, I'm hoping for rain every day because I have my John G. Rain Runner on, and I love it. Rain or shine, it's a great-looking, great-feel jacket.
And coincidentally, what jacket did I put on? I put on my John G. Rain Runner jacket.
They have different colors, thankfully, so we don't look like we're the twinsies, but the colors are great. But I also have the John G. shorts on today, and what I love about those is just attention to detail. You know, everything needs to stand out on its own. The waistband, really awesome feel to it. It's functional. It's just not an afterthought. The string that they use, the small pocket that's on the inside, the material, the way it stretches, they just really set out to do a good job with the product, and they left no stone unturned. Kind of like us today running, Scott. We kicked a lot of stones today.
Luckily, we didn't go down because I wouldn't want to put any abrasions on my John G. jacket. I want to say I'm glad they make different colors because I like my color way better than yours. Mine's is kind of a pumpkin color. They're going to get mad at me for saying that because I don't know what the exact color that they call that. But I really like the color I have.
Well, I'm glad you like it because I like the one that I have here. I'm glad you handed me this one. So go out, check out John G.'s gear. There's 15% off right now.
Yep. If you go to our deals page and click on the banner, then use the code TRN15, you can get 15% off. And you'll find out, like we did very quickly, just great gear, good quality and usability.
Now, back to the show with Chris.
You know, the one of the great things about the book is it was a received if you were a runner, but also very well received if you weren't a runner. To this day, I think it's one of my wife's favorite books, and she reads a lot, and she's not a runner. She just loved the stories of the characters that you had in there during the race down in the Copper Canyons. But then there's the whole science back of it, where you bumped into all these scientists that are saying, and I can't remember, sorry, the guy's name that worked at University of Utah that would go up to Wyoming and chase after an antelope. I mean, just fascinating that we're kind of rediscovering what we're made of. And I think that was eye-opening for a lot of people. How did that all come about? And what surprised you the most?
Well, you know, the good thing was, pardon me, the good thing was, at the time I was writing the book, I was still a real newcomer to this world. And I just met Scott. Scott was like one of the first ultra runners I ever met. I met Barefoot Ted, first barefoot dude I ever met. And so this was a whole new topic of research for me. And I think the book reflects that. I think I was fortunate to write the book at a time when I really wasn't sure what I was talking about. And I think if I had written it with a couple more years of experience under my belt, it might have been a much more irritating book, you know, because I would have just been waving a finger like, you know, you people need to listen, as opposed to like, I'm not quite sure, but here's what I found out so far. And what I started to explore was, I was just trying to understand how it all made sense. So, you know, I'm down there with the Tarahumara. I see they're wearing sandals. Barefoot Ted shows up. He's running barefoot or in five fingers. He is spewing the gospel of barefoot running. I'm kind of skeptical, but I want to see if there's anything behind it. So I start looking into research and realize, yeah, there's a ton of research that actually endorses this idea. I'm wondering how it is that the Tarahumara are still running at 70 and 80 years old when we're told that you're supposed to be breaking down. And that led me to looking into the 2004 paper by doctors Carrier, Bramble, and Lieberman that you just referenced about the fact that humans evolved as long-distance runners. So every little question led me to a different thread. And all of it was designed for me to try and make sense of this experience that I just had.
And that's one of the motivating factors of the book, where as you're reading this and taking with your skepticism as the author and then seeing how it evolves, and then you think, you know what, TV watching, Cheeto eating, couch living guy. And that's not who I'm destined to be. That's not who I was designed to be. I'm going to go put on my socks or even my barefoot, and I'm going to go out the door and I'm going to run around the block because that's what I was designed for. And I think that's why a lot of people really love the book, because it motivated them to become better.
And that's part of what Mark Cucuzzella's message was, and Steve Gangemi, Sock Doc, is take your shoes off, go out onto a surface you can tolerate, and trust yourself, and just do what you do naturally. Forget about all the instruction and all the gimmicks and ideas and theories. Just go out and run and have fun.
I had that exact experience. I was in a radio interview one time. It was like in Minnesota or something. And so some guy called into the show, and he started to ask a lot of questions about barefoot running. Like, you know, how should I do it? And I said, I'll tell you what, you know, this is an hour-long program. You know, is it cold outside? No, not so bad. Why don't you just go outside and run and call back? So the guy hangs up the phone, and then we continue the interview on the air. And then like 30 minutes later, he calls back in, and he goes like, yeah, I just ran around the block barefoot. How was it? And he's like, you know, ecstatic and excited and happy. But it was funny that his first reaction was to ask a lot of questions. Like it had to come through his head first, as opposed to through his body, instead of just going out the door and just trying it, you know? So, I mean, that's the way we are. We're analytical animals. We want to understand things before we take a risk. And I think it slows us down too much.
You know, I've done some gait analysis and teaching to some folks, and I wouldn't say anything to them. I would take them to the back. I would put the iPhone on slow motion, and I would have them run with their shoes and just run through the strip. And I'd say, okay, now take your shoes off and do the same thing. And then without saying anything, we'd go back into the room and we watch their gait change drastically. And they go, wow, I'm not overstriding. I'm landing with my foot right underneath me. And my cadence has picked up. It's not as long. And I never said a single word. And I said, there you go.
Yeah, that's
you taught yourself. You knew.
That's unfortunately the problem, too, with this, is that it's very hard to translate movement into language. And so when people ask you what to do, you're guaranteed you're going to say something, you know, that's going to send them the wrong direction. So the less you say, the better.
Yeah.
So 3 million books, I think, is what I read. Do you have a better figure on that?
That's the one I've been hearing too, yeah.
Three million copies sold. It's on Audible. It's a great read. I've actually been motivated to go back. I have it on Audible. I'm going to go back and re-listen to it because there's so many good stories. Fast forward, you know, you've sold 3 million copies and it's time to write a new book. And the new book that comes out after, the follow-up book, is Natural Born Heroes. And again, such a great book. How did that evolve? I mean, I would almost think that you've done this great job with Born to Run, that you do Born to Run 2 or the sequel to Born to Run 2. And you've kind of, although there is some running and athleticism in Natural Born Heroes, it kind of moves away from that. How did that evolve?
So what happened was, when I started working on Born to Run, I kind of threw out the fishing net to get as many books about running as I could find. And back then, there really weren't that many. And the ones that were most interesting were these out-of-print books, things about Percy Cerruti or Arthur Lydiard, you know, these old training manuals from the 40s and 50s, Ron Dawes, you know, all these old self-taught dudes. So I got their books, and then I came across one called The Cretan Runner. And I just assumed it was about some kind of, like, you know, Greek Olympic marathoner. So I bought that one, too, not really understanding what it was. And then when I got the book, I looked at it and go, oh, this doesn't help. This is about World War II. You know, it's about World War II resistance fighters. So I kind of tossed it aside, wrote Born to Run. And then after I finished writing the book, there's this 9 months of downtime between the time you finish the manuscript and before it comes out. So suddenly after this like frantic effort for like 3 years, all of a sudden you're in limbo. Like, now what? So I started clearing out these books that I wasn't going to be using anymore. And I came across this Cretan Runner book, and I hadn't read it yet, so I read it. It was the story of a resistance fighter on the Greek island of Crete during World War II. And this guy was running messages back and forth to different bands of resistance fighters. So I'm reading the book, and it's pretty interesting. But there's this moment where you just pause, and you check and go, wait a minute, what the fuck did I just read? Like, you back it up and go, you did what? You ran 50 miles through the mountain, in the dark, in the cold, off trail, because if you're on the trails, that's where the Germans could catch you. You joined up with a band, you fought hand-to-hand combat, you sold a bunch of weapons, and you went 50 miles back. Like, all right, that's a 100-mile ultra you did off trail with, like, no silver blanket or orange slices, with some hand-to-hand combat in between. Like, physically, you know, give me Scott Jurek, put him in that situation. I guarantee you Scott Jurek's not coming out alive, you know? So how right. the hell does this civilian do this? And that became my question was, and I started to look into what resistance fighters were all about. And, you know, that term resistance fighters, you sort of think of Navy SEAL. It gives you an image in your mind of someone like, you know, battle hardened. But resistance fighters were just civilians. And what was unique about Crete is that Crete, that Greek island, it's the only place where the resistance began the first day. So when, you know, the Germans rolled into France, they defeated the French army, and then the French citizens kind of waited about 9 or 10 months. They put together a little militia, and then they began the resistance about 9 months later. On Crete, the Germans were literally coming down parachutes, and grandmothers are like grabbing forks and running out, and knives running out into the street that day. And it was men and women alike were just battling the Germans the second they arrived. So these were not, you know, Delta Force who'd been trained for this. These were civilians who'd been living peacefully on this island until the day the Germans showed up. And then overnight, they just clicked into these, like, ultra-marathon running, like, super warriors. So my question was, physically, how do you do this? Because similar to, like, with the Tarahumara, I was with this culture, and they're doing something that I couldn't do. And my question was, well, how do you do it? And same with natural born heroes. How do you physically pull this kind of stuff off? And then ultimately it led to the story that was bizarre. So these resistance fighters on Crete actually kidnapped the German general who's occupying the island and went on the run through the mountains for 45 days, being pursued by 100,000 German soldiers. And that's really the narrative. But within the narrative, I get to talk to guys like Steve Gangemi, guys who are natural movement specialists, who can describe how they physically pulled it off.
And I remember a part where you're following around some guy in the tall brambles, and he's an overweight, was he a sheep herder or something like that?
No, he's a psychologist. He's a psychologist from the UK, yeah.
And here you are trying to keep up with him and going, what the crap is going on here? This guy is outworking me. And it shouldn't be that way. And how you kind of explain and try to make sense of that is just wonderful.
It was a really cool thing. I met a guy from the UK, Chris White, who was a psychologist. But he'd been going back to Crete over and over again because he was in pursuit of the same question. He wanted to know, like, the trail of the kidnappers. And he had adopted that thing they call the Cretan bounce, where instead of forcing yourself to move with muscular force, you just let your body just kind of spring along like kangaroo style. And this guy had learned it from the shepherds, and he just, like, took off like Tigger, man, and it was, like, impossible to keep up with him.
Wow.
Great, great, great book. Now let's fast forward to the latest book, which is Running with Sherman. And I knew about this book, but until Don and I started doing a little bit more research and did the podcast with Brian Metzler about burro racing, I didn't connect the dots. Tell us about Sherman. How did you come? You kind of just adopted Sherman somewhere, right? How did that come about?
Was it the other way around? Did Sherman adopt you?
Kind of like that. Yeah, kind of like that. So what happened was, you know, we were living in Peach Bottom, Pennsylvania, an Amish community in the middle of nowhere, outskirts of sort of halfway between Philly and Baltimore. And my daughter, we were out on a hike one day, and we heard, like, these hooves clattering behind us. And we turn around, and there's a woman riding a donkey coming up the trail. And, you know, out in Colorado, that might be a little bit more of a common sight. But in Pennsylvania, like, nobody's riding around, you know, horseback on a donkey. So we were all kind of charmed by this. And it was really cool, and the woman was hilarious and real fun. She hops off the saddle, and everyone's petting the donkey and feeding it carrots. And then, you know, this woman just kind of rides off into the distance and never to be seen again. But it registered in my 9-year-old daughter's brain that this is something that she wanted. Never mentioned it again until her 10th birthday. And I'm like, all right, hey, Soph, what do you want for your birthday? And she says, a donkey. And I kind of got why. It's because when you look at donkeys, they're kind of kid-sized. They're kid-friendly. They're not these big, towering horses for, you know, for grown-ups. So in her brain, she had this romantic vision that she's going to get this donkey and she's going to be able to ride it to school and like leave it out in the soccer field and saddle up and ride home, which in Peach Bottom is actually, you know, pretty plausible. So I thought, you know, it's kind of dig this idea. Let's see if we can find a donkey and let Sophie become like a horseback riding donkey owner. So I asked around and we did have a neighbor, because there aren't many donkeys in Pennsylvania. And we had a neighbor who knew a guy who was a hoarder, and they knew this guy had a donkey locked up in a stall, and they were trying to get this animal out of his hands. So he said, this could be a win-win. Why don't you help us? And then we went to look at this animal, and it was not the donkey we were looking for. The one we'd seen our friend ride on horseback was like one of these beautiful groomed, like pack mule donkeys. And this thing was in horrible, horrible shape. It had been locked in a stall in manure and rotten straw for years and looked like it was on its deathbed. So my first thought was like, this is not coming home with us. But then my second thought was, we definitely got to get this thing out of here. So we ended up taking it home, basically more to help the donkey than to give my daughter her birthday present. But fortunately, it turned out well for everybody, because with some TLC, that donkey just bloomed and turned into a tremendous character.
And how did you decide this thing would be a running partner and you'd go out on trail runs with this donkey? Did you know about burro racing at that point?
Well, you know, I did and I didn't. I had actually been in a burro race about 10 years earlier. So when I started researching Born to Run, you know, Born to Run was also born out of a real misconception. So I knew that the Tarahumara had run in Leadville in the mid-90s, like 93, 94, and then never to return. And my suspicion was, well, there's only one reason why the defending champion is not invited back. It's because probably these Colorado miners didn't like the fact that these guys from Mexico were like tuning the crap out of their American runners and they were like shutting them out. So when I first came down to Leadville, just to begin my early research into Born to Run, I went down to interview Ken Klober, who created the Leadville Trail 100. And I came in with this conception of like, all right, this backcountry redneck is prejudiced and he is keeping the Tarahumara out. And about 30 seconds, he disabused me of that misconception. But also, he's such a fun-loving dude with this undiagnosed ADHD, I'm convinced, because within 5 minutes, he answered all my questions, but he's getting antsy, like, you know, why are we sitting inside? So he takes me out snowshoeing up into the mountains, and we're having a ball. And he just starts telling me his life story and talked about how he first visited Leadville right around the time of the Boom Days festival in August, and he saw his first burro race, and he was like on fire. And then he tells me, you got to do it. And he actually made it sound as if it would be fun. So I actually came back for a burro race, and this would have been, I don't know, man, 2004 or something, and it sucked. It was the worst. Terrible. And because I'm at 12,000 feet with a 2,000-pound animal that wants nothing to do with me. Anyway, I did it and then wrote an article about it and promptly forgot about it. So I'm like, man, I'm this top of the list of things I will never do again. But then when we adopted this donkey, I was able to find that woman named Tanya, who we'd seen on the trail. So I had this sick donkey in my backyard. I don't know what to do with it. So I asked around to my neighbors, like, hey, anybody know who that woman was who rides the donkey? And if you live in Lancaster and you're a woman who rides a donkey in the woods, like, everybody knows who you are. So
there's not a lot of those.
She stood alone. So they gave me her number. And so I called this woman, Tanya, and she comes racing to the rescue. And she sees this donkey, and she's horrified at the condition it's in. And she starts to, you know, shoot it with antibiotics and pain relievers and pulls a loose tooth out of its mouth and is working on its hooves. And then she turns around to me with this, like, look of fire in her eye. And she goes, now listen, don't think if he gets better, you're just going to stick him out in a field with a bow on his ass like Eeyore. This animal needs a job. It needs a purpose. It's feeling despair. You can see the despair in its eyes. you got to give it a job. And I'm so intimidated by this 5'2" fireball that I'm just like nodding along. Okay, yeah, whatever you say. But I'm like, I'm not a prospector. Like, I don't have a job for a donkey. And I started to think, and all of a sudden I knew something else about myself. I don't know if it's true of you guys, but if you tell me something's good for me, I'm probably not going to do it. You know, if it's something I ought to do, I'm not going to do it. If you tell me, like, I got to give up sugar, I'll give it up for, like, a freaking day, and then right back to the Haagen-Dazs. But if it's something that I want to do, I'll be super regular about it. So I like to run, right? So I'm out for a run every day. And so I started to think in my mind, all right, I got to find a job for this donkey. I know I'm going to quit if I don't like it. So what's a job that I actually feel like doing myself? And I started to think, well, what if I can make this guy my running partner? And then the next step was, oh, hang on a second. We can actually train for a race. So all those things just came flooding through my brain at once. It needs a job. I'm not going to do a job unless I want to do it. I like to run. Maybe we can get together and do a borough race.
So let me ask you, Chris, did Sherman say, I like to run and I like this job? Or was he like, I don't like Chris's job. I'll do it for a day, but then I'm done with it.
I'm back to the Haagen-Dazs.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was a real education for me because I'm like, yeah, you know, let's get the donkey to run. And like the donkey's like, dude, I'm a donkey. You know, like, I've got 10,000 years of telling guys like you to F off. We have a reputation for being stubborn. So it was a huge education to me. And I hope it sank into my DNA. I'm not sure if it did, but you know, if you're trying to communicate with a nonverbal creature, you can't discuss this plan with the donkey. So somehow you got to communicate with a creature that doesn't share your own language. And it really teaches you that you have to like pay attention. You've got to like look and observe, and you have to, it was Hal Walter, Curtis Emery. Sorry. It was Curtis Emery, who's like the great dean of burrow racing. He said that, anything you want a donkey to do, you got to make the donkey think it was his idea first. And to me, like, that's the great secret of like all human relations. Like, anytime you have a disagreement with somebody and you want to get them to do something, try to make them think that they thought of it first. And so that became the quest of running with Sherman, was how do we somehow plant this idea in this donkey's brain that he's the one that wants to go out and run 5 miles today, and these humans just happen to be trailing along. And that became the cool challenge, but it started to work.
Okay, so you can't stop there. How did you?
Buy the book, Scott. Buy the book.
Oh, man, I'm happy to go on. I like telling this story. So yeah, the way you solve the problem with a donkey, we found out, is just throw more donkeys at the problem. So we struggled for a long time. Sherman wasn't going anywhere. Sherman was not leaving the yard. His hooves were very ginger. They had not been treated well for a long time. But we did notice that there was a goat named Lawrence that he would follow around. So wherever Lawrence went, Sherman would go. So first we started just leading the goat, and Sherman would follow the goat. And then we realized it didn't necessarily have to be a goat, that in a pinch, I could step in for the goat, which I think is probably true in most circumstances. You need a goat, I'll step in. But he would follow me around. So then we got Tanya to come over with her riding donkey, and then she would ride her donkey, and then Sherman would trot along behind. But then that donkey was kind of skittish. It was afraid of things like, it was afraid of the color yellow. Like, it was like a warning street sign. Like, this donkey would, you know, rear back. But Tanya had another donkey that was really fearless named Matilda. So we ended up with a third donkey. So that's how it kind of snowballed. But what we found was, and this is, I guess, kind of true of us too, that the things we don't want to do, if you turn it into a team event, then it becomes fun. And
training partners.
Totally.
Training partners.
Yeah, totally. You know, the people to keep you honest. But even beyond mm-hmm. that, it's not that they're forcing you to. You just enjoy it more. It's more fun. So that became the way we cracked the code of making Sherman into a distance runner, was just by surrounding him with more donkeys.
Did Sherman keep you honest? Did Sherman come wake you up in the morning and say, come on, Chris, time to go do the 5 mile run?
Well, there are two people. So Sherman, for sure. So Sherman got into this thing where, you know, one morning I wake up, I look outside and I see all the animals. So we have a bunch of sheep and goats and chickens and things. I look outside and everybody is loose. There's like 20 goats and sheep and three donkeys wandering up the road. I'm like, what the shit? So I go outside and I herd them all up and I put them away. And of course, I'm blaming my wife. Like, you must not have closed the gate. Like, I closed the gate. you left the gate open. So we're, you know, kind of pointing the finger at each other. And the next day it happens again. And I'm damn sure that gate was closed. We realized what Sherman was doing was the gate was held by a chain. Sherman, when he was ready to go at like 8 in the morning for a run, he would take the chain in his teeth and then shake his head and then throw the chain off the gate and then bang the gate open with his head and just take off and go. he was turning it like a safe cracker. But that was it. He had gotten so into it that by our normal running time in the day, he was ready to get up and go.
As far as horses go, or that type, that species, donkeys are very, very smart. I understand they're we don't expect them to be because maybe they're not tall and maybe they have big ears, so they can't be smart. I don't know what the rationale is, but donkeys are extremely intelligent.
Yeah, so I think the reputation for being dumb comes from the fact that they're stubborn.
And
it's not that they don't get it. It's just that they decide they're not going to do it. And there's a big difference between dumb and stubborn. And so,
I think they go hand in hand. I think actually they're so smart that they say, I don't have to do that.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Well, that's exactly it. And that's why they're actually prized. That's why you had them in the Rocky Mountains. Because if you're a prospector heading off into unknown regions, high 12,000 feet on a trail that's not really a trail. You know, the thing about horses is horses have been bred like dogs to take our orders. A horse will do what you tell it to do. That's why, horses will Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, those horses jumped off a cliff into the river. You've never seen a donkey jump into a river. That's never going to freaking happen. Because donkeys have been bred for self-preservation. They are out and they're not going to do anything unless they're damn sure it's safe. So if you're a prospector, that's actually the animal you want. Because if a donkey comes around a bend in the trail and it's not convinced it's safe, the donkey will just lock up and freeze and not move. And you can beat the crap out of it. It's not going. And that was actually a trait that the prospectors and the miners and explorers really prized. They wanted that caution. And so that's why they kept it in their donkeys. And so there it is today. The donkey, it will just shut down if it's not convinced it's completely safe.
Best-selling author Christopher McDougall has stories and there's a lot of authors that come on, but not ones that tell stories like you. You're a great storyteller, and you can also go from words to language and write it down for us to read. Both enjoyable. Such a fun conversation. Here's my question. Girl Trouble. Can you get that book anywhere? Is it on Amazon? Can we...
Do you sell some copies in your basement?
Yeah, let's sell those things.
It's funny because to answer your question, I'm not sure. They've got to be around there somewhere. I'm sure an Amazon used bookseller had it. But when I was digging through my boxes of unsold books, there were actually promotional copies that were wrapped up in a fishnet stocking, which became the best prizes I had. So for these giveaway prizes, I would hold up this book about a sex cult wrapped in a fishnet stocking, who wants this? And hands were flying in the air. So I moved a ton of them. I gave away more as raffle prizes in the past 6 months than I sold in 10 years.
Hey, so let's rate that book. You become the critic for a second. One of your best works, or one that's probably best in a basement. What do you think?
I don't know, because I've never reread any of my books. The thing about it is it is such a grind. It's a 2-year spinal tap to do a book. At least it is for me. There's so much self doubt that goes on that by the time you're done, you never want to see it again. And so, to this day, we'll discuss Born to Run, and all of a sudden I'll remember, oh yeah, chia seeds. I forgot that was in there. I haven't looked at Born to Run since I finished it in 2008. And Girl Trouble was a couple years before that. So to answer your question, I got no freaking idea. It's either an undiscovered masterpiece or it's going to haunt me to my dying day.
And maybe that's when it becomes like a Picasso. After you leave, it's going to go into several print editions.
I am not sure if I want to be remembered as the author of Girl Trouble. There's a lot of ways I can go down. I think I'd rather go down as a bank robber, than the guy who. But maybe so. Who knows? Like I said, it's a pretty cool story. So maybe someone out there will actually read it and get back to us and say, you know what? This thing, forget Born to Run. We should be talking Girl Trouble all the time.
Well, they kind of tie together. If you have Girl Trouble, you got to run. So, maybe the dots connect here.
That's right. Born a whole ass.
or get a donkey and go into the mountains.
Disappear. Yeah.
Chris, what do you do these days? Are you still putting pen to paper?
Yeah, I'm working on a new book now and going through that same kind of miserable process. I actually woke up this morning thinking, you know what, I should just not do it. Like, you know, what if I just... You know, I started weighing the options. Like, can I get away with just never ever doing this thing? So, yeah, I'm early on in the process. You know, books have this evolution where when you have the idea, like, oh my God, this is unbelievable. This is the Bible. And then you write the proposal and you're even more sold on it. And then you sit down and write and everything's just deflated. Not that you don't want to do it. Just the whole thing just seems terrible. So, yeah, that's where I am right now.
How many ideas get thrown away? You have this great brainstorm, and then it moves off before it gets to a publisher.
Now I tend to follow through. I think I learned a lesson with Born to Run. So Girl Trouble was kind of a spontaneous deal. What happened was I'd written this article for the New York Times Magazine about that sex cult, and when it came out on the cover of the magazine, I started getting calls from publishers like the next day, like, hey, dude, you should do a book. I'm like, okay. But I didn't really know what that meant. And so what I did was I basically wrote a chapter at a time and just fired the chapter off to the publisher. Like, wrote chapter one, send it off. Chapter two, send it off. And in the course of like 3 months, I did this book and it was compiled and sent out. So that was almost like the throwaway pancake. You don't really count that one. So Born to Run was the first time I really tried to sit down and conscientiously write a book the right way. And it was tough. It took me 2 years to do it, but it taught me, I think, kind of an important lesson, is that if you're going to write a book and invest 2 years in it, you got to know that there's a really good story there and something, a lot left to be undiscovered, that's going to keep your interest for 2 years. And so I only choose books like Natural Born Heroes and Running with Sherman where I feel like there's enough there that I don't know that's going to keep me intrigued.
Yeah, I never thought of that. I mean, if you're working on a book for 2 years, it's got to be something you're going to wake up every morning and be passionate about.
Yeah, yeah. And so there haven't been any ideas that I've explored that I haven't, you know, followed through to the finish line, because at some point you just suck it up. Like, ah, well, you know, this is just my life for the next year. So suck it up and do it. So you know the idea is good. You just got to have the discipline to just keep plodding forward.
Well, we're glad you're plodding forward. Relentless forward motion is a theme, and we're so happy you did. Not only the time for this podcast, Chris, but how you've influenced the whole running community. So, you know, I'll speak for all runners and say thank you so much for bringing your ideas and bringing the characters that were in your story and the ideas that each one of the characters held and sharing them with us in a very enjoyable way, in a way that we could all embrace and kind of raise the Chris McDougall flag and said, thank you.
Well, let me say thank you back to you guys, because, you know, the stories I'm writing about and telling are your guys' stories. You know, Jen Shelton never asked anybody to write a book about her. You know, Barefoot Ted never asked me to go probing into his life. And so I've been privileged to see these really cool stories about people and tell them. And if you guys all weren't out there, I'd have nothing to talk about.
You know, I was thinking, you know, Barefoot Ted has this very successful sandal company now. And I'm sure that was influenced by the popularity of the book. I think I read somewhere on social media, Jen Shelton is pregnant or has a baby now. You know, she grew up. Who knew that would happen?
I know. Jen is a mother right now. Yeah.
And Steve Sashin with the zero drop shoes. I mean, there's a number of people that were born out of your book, Born to Run.
Yeah, but again, conversely, I was telling their stories. They were out there, you know. So I feel this real gratitude that there is this culture, this tribe of runners out there that are out there in the wilderness, you know, living their lives, and that they do things that we're all interested in. And I get the lucky chance to tell their stories.
Yeah, when you said tribe, you know, we've kind of, as you look at our logo, and we call ourselves a tribe, very possibly right from Born to Run, very tribal, very, you know, from the beginnings. We've kind of talked about that. So I think, Scott, we've been taking credit for Chris's doings.
Subliminally, he created this podcast, huh?
As usual, we kind of take it and then reprocess it a little bit and then call it our own invention. So
yeah, I'm right with you.
We should probably thank Chris and give him the credit. Thanks. Thanks for joining us, Chris. We'd love to do it again sometime.
Oh, guys.
Yeah, let us know when you get past the 2 years of agony and the 9 years of downtime, and we'll help you with that new book.
Yeah, man, or even just check in, like distract me from it. Let's just talk about something else. But, guys, I really enjoyed it a lot. This was a ton of fun.
Yeah, for us, too. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Go out and run.
Mas.
Yeah, you got it, guys.
You got to stay tuned for next week's podcast. It will be our Christmas podcast, and it's with AJW and a good friend that we haven't had on for a long time, Sally McRae.
What a gift for Christmas, Scott, to get a chance to sit down and read an audio magazine with two of our favorite guests of all time.
Do you read an audio magazine?
In this case, we do. Yeah, you have to read into the topics and try to read into the meaning behind some of these articles. So, yeah, it's absolutely.
You did that very, very well.
And you also ran me over with a bus on this next episode. And yeah. Then AJW put it in reverse and stomped on your foot, and you guys backed over me together.
You will need to tune in next week because my cheeks hurt. Because I was laughing so much. And of course, you have Sally McRae's infamous laugh. So tune in next week.
We've come to the end of the show, and it's time for the credits, the people that helped put this thing together.
We want to give credit where credit is due. We want to thank our producer, Doug Mayer, who lives in Chamonix, France, and produces the show from the base of those wonderful Alps.
And Ethan Stark Miller. He's our editor. He makes us sound right.
He makes us sound good. And we have Tate Pullman, who is doing our editorial assistant work in between winning races.
What about the staff photographer, Scott, or the person that preps our green room? They don't get credit?
Well, we do have somebody that makes sure that there's fresh flowers in the vase in the green room, and they prefer to be anonymous. That's stupid.